Welcome to the Cricket Central Show. I'm Amit Masram, and with me today, Lawrence Booth, acclaimed English cricket writer. His Daily Mail column, The Top Spin, was adjudged online column of the year for 2009 at the prestigious Sports Journalists Association Awards earlier this year. He's been playing a solid innings on the writing crease for the last 12 years. His fourth book is a collection of quotes entitled What Are the Butchers For? And Jared Kimber, a maverick Australian writer based in London. His blog cricketwithballs.com is among the top 5 most popular cricket blogs on the web. His latest book, Ashes 2009, When Freddie Became Jesus, is on sale. In the show today, we'll have a preview in the build-up to the Ashes series, the comparison between both the sides, who has got the better chance of retaining the urn or probably have one hand on the urn, and plenty more. England will start their defense of the Ashes series. What promises to be a thrilling affair. I'll first fire an opening salvo to Lawrence Booth. Lawrence, now you've been following the fortunes of England cricket for quite some time. What do you reckon is the composition of the side? Is it a balanced side that's going to the Ashes series this time around? Because we know that the last time when England had gone to Australia, there are lots of problems in terms of unsettled captaincy issue. There was Andrew Flintoff, there was Andrew Strauss as well. And the captaincy issue was just going bigger and bigger with an unfit Michael Vaughan. But this time around, they looked a pretty assured and settled side.
Well, they've got the captain they want. There's no doubt about that. They've got the team they want. And it's been a long time since England have gone to Australia with everyone fit. No dropouts. We've had guys like Thorpe and Trescothick pulling out for various reasons before in the past. And the balance they're going to go for is 6 batsmen and 4 bowlers, with Swan shouldering a lot of work as the one spinner. 3 main seamers, Collingwood being perhaps bowling 8 or 10 overs a day if they're lucky. So they're taking a bit of a risk. They're putting a lot on Swan's shoulders. He's the informed spinner in world cricket at the moment. And they're kind of, I mean, if Swan doesn't fire, they could be in serious trouble. That's my concern. But it's a classic sort of balanced team, the one that Australia have gone with for many years. Of course, they had Warner McGrath, so they could get away with it. But England are banking on Swan shouldering a lot of overs and the seamers rotating.
Jared, England obviously are pretty confident and assured of their presence and their chances in the Ashes series. But in terms of Australia, now Ricky Ponting is under a lot of scrutiny of late because he's lost just a series in India, and now things are looking even more ominous. Knives are getting sharpened up. If he loses that series, then probably he will have a very torrid time and his captaincy might be over.
Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. I can't see them ever actually sacking Ricky Ponting, to be honest. I think he can ride his own ticket. What might happen, though, is if he loses a series at home to England, he might just pack it in. I think that's a far more likely scenario than him going. He probably won't want to go at the moment. Currently in the middle of getting rid of Michael Clarke as potential vice-captain by the talk in the media. There's no one else really to take over, so I don't think he's going to lose the captaincy, but there's a lot of problems in that team at the moment, and a lot of them come from the fact that they're carrying a few old players who they won't get rid of.
And especially, this is the 7th series for Ricky Ponting as a player, and he would like to have a resume which reads Ashes winning captain. And how do you rate Australia's chances going into the Ashes series? A lot of media scrutiny, a lot of criticism from the Australian media in particular.
Yeah, I think they've earned the criticism. You've got to play hard to get that sort of criticism. They've played terrible just enough times to earn it. But I don't think any of that really is going to matter too much, because over a 5-test series, even if they start off without the momentum that you take into a test series, I think they've got enough time to get it back. They've got an amazing record at the Gabba. They probably know that they have a better suited bowling attack to the Australian conditions than England do. So I don't think all the other stuff's going to worry them too much. They've still got a pretty good team. So I think maybe the bigger problem will be for some of the players who are playing for their place. And that might be a problem for England, because Australian players who play for their place usually play pretty well, don't they?
Interestingly, Jared, you just brought the point. There has been a lot of talk about the venues also coming into the equation. Brisbane also happens to be the series starter. If any sides manage to win that match upfront, then they go with a momentum. But having said that, do you think Australia have the firepower in their bowling capability to actually take 20 wickets? There is no Glenn McGrath. There is no Shane Warne. A lot of burden will be on the shoulders of Mitchell Johnson in particular.
Yeah, well, there hasn't been a Glenn McGrath or Shane Warne for a while, so I don't think the hangover really will worry them too much. I think if they pick four quick bowlers out of Bollinger, Johnson, Hilfenhaus, Siddle and Harris, and forget about the use of the rubbish spinners that they have, then they have four bowlers who can take 20 wickets in Australia without a shadow of a doubt. I also think they have more bowling depth if they get injuries than England does. So I don't have a problem with them taking 20 wickets. My problem is that they won't pick those four quick bowlers. They'll pick Horrocks and he'll get his two or three wickets, and then they'll say, but he was plucky, so we'll keep him around, rather than just, you know, murdering him like I would.
I'll just come back to Lawrence now. Lawrence, interestingly, a lot of optimism in the England camp in terms of their prospects in Ashes series. But those are not swinging conditions that you will find in Australia. Typically, conditions will favour the batsmen who can make their runs in Australia. You might just find 500 as a regularity in Australia. Where do England look to for taking those 20 wickets to probably have one hand onto the Ashes run?
Well, you say there's a lot of optimism in the England camp. I mean, I think most of the optimism is in the English media. Every time an English player is asked about record in Australia since the fabled 86-87, which Mike Gatting has dined out on for a lifetime, is appalling. And they are overly reliant on one man, Graham Swann. Now, don't forget, Swann averaged 40, I think, in England's victorious 2009 Ashes series. He had two good games, which actually for a spinner in a five-test series is just about enough. You say, if you win us two games, you've done your job. But conditions are not going to help him in Australia. He's going to be reliant, I think, on the fact that he's going to be bowling to a lot of left-handers, that umpires, because of the way Hawkeye works, are now more tempted to give LBWs out. So, you know, Swann could be a big factor. But if he has an off series, who's going to take those wickets? Will Jimmy Anderson? Kookaburra's not going to swing for more than about 10 overs. He averaged 80, 82 last time out. That's being sort of that's hanging over him like the sword of Damocles at the moment. Then you're looking at someone like Finn, who's a novice. And then you're saying Stuart Broad, who generally has one good match-winning performance a series. Now, England might say, that's enough. If Swann wins us a game and Broad wins us a game, that's two tests and that may be enough. But these are fine margins and, you know, I'm not as optimistic as some observers, shall we say.
So are you saying that the English media are all full of shit?
No, you're putting words into my mouth there, Jared.
That's a bit of banter going on between an Aussie and the English side. So yes, interestingly, I think Swann has got a huge amount of responsibility on his shoulders because James Anderson, he will be spearheading the England bowling attack. What do you reckon? Because you rightly mentioned, I think it's not the Duke's ball that's going to be played. It's the Kookaburra ball. In that situation, I think the bowlers will have a very torrid time in Australia.
Well, that's a fair point. I mean, in fairness to Anderson, he's a better bowler now than he was 4 years ago when he was in the middle of a pretty rough spell for England where he was being treated as a kind of almost a net bowler. The time you saw Anderson most frequently was during the lunch interval, bowling at a single stump and looking in a complete sort of strop the whole time. It's got to swing. He's got to aim for the stumps. This sounds like an obvious thing, but in the first 10 overs, when it's swinging, he's got to make the batsman play. I was speaking to Nasser Hussain today, and he said, look, Alan Mullally used to bowl 7 overs, 5 maidens, none for 2, but they'd just be little outswingers outside off stump, hopeless with the new ball. In Australia, you've got to make that new ball count. If Jimmy doesn't succeed, they're not in serious trouble, but they're then reliant on the old ball reversing. He did bowl a good spell against Pakistan on the last day of the Oval Test, which England lost, but Jimmy got the old ball to go in a way that I hadn't seen before and made me think, hang on, he could actually do something with the old ball. That could be the key, you know. Good new ball spell and come back around 40, 50 overs when it's reversing and try and recreate some of the mood of 2005, which England won with reverse swing.
I'll just draw in Jared here because Shane Watson is in terrific form. Probably he's hit a purple patch. Now, if James Anderson is not able to break through or the England bowlers do not manage to account for the openers, then you've got ominous signs already because Simon Cattish, established campaigner, and you've got Shane Watson, who is a stroke player.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a problem for England, but the thing is, you only really need to get the first 3 wickets of Australia right at the moment, and you're into the tail. So, I don't think it, you know, there's many times when Australia's been none for 80 and all out for 160 of recent times. They seem to collapse the minute Watson or Cattish goes out. So, I don't think that's as big a problem. The bigger problem is if Ponting really plays the way he was playing in India, where it looks like he's going to put a huge value on his wicket, because he can make partnerships with someone like Clark or someone further down the order, and that's where England's going to have their problem. Kookaburras don't really reverse swing in Australia very much. So, I mean, that's going to be a problem for the English bowlers because they're better at it than the Australian bowlers. And also, I mean, it's going to swing a little bit at the Gabba early on. It might swing at the Wacca if you get the right wind. But if it doesn't swing at those two places, England have gone in with a very, very light attack with an off-spinner who doesn't use bounce as well as other off-spinners in a country where you have to use bounce.
But generally speaking, again, coming back to the point of optimism and a lot of assurance and the sides looking pretty strong on paper, I think England look pretty strong. But do you really believe that Australia are quietly just digesting all the media scrutiny that is happening, but they still are very potent side at the moment?
They have the 11 players they need to win the Ashes, but whether they put those 11 players out on the field is going to be the thing. They're in the middle of a weird time because they have a lot of players over the last few years, and Stuart Clarke and Mike Hussey are a perfect example of this, of guys who came in at about 30 who have all this experience that Ricky Ponting really likes them. Ricky Ponting doesn't really like young players as much. So whether it seems to be that they're trying to hold on to guys like North and Hussey and even Kadic to a certain extent when they could be actually bringing in younger players who might be able to do the job as good or better. Now, that seems to be causing problems with Michael Clarke. It seems to be causing problems with the selectors. So I think they might be mildly imploding. I just don't think that's going to be an issue when the Ashes come around, though.
Interestingly, Merv Hewitt has been X'd out of the selection panel. How do you see that actually as a psychological blow just heading into the Ashes series?
I think that's the best thing they could have possibly done. Why would you have a selector who doesn't watch cricket? A man who didn't have pay TV and could only watch Channel 9 cricket. He would watch 5 tests a year. A complete useless waste of a selector that he was. Hardly went to any first class games, other than the fact that, you know, everyone liked Merv. He was a waste of space. Now, having said that, I don't like Greg Chappell, so he's his replacement.
Having said that, yes, I think that's a very valid point because Greg Chappell is a much more sophisticated version, non-compromising, but not has the right record to back his credentials.
Well, I mean, he ruined South Australia and then ruined India. And the last time I heard, the Australia A boys didn't like playing for him either. So as a coach, he's pathetic. But what Cricket Australia basically said, yeah, he's a terrible coach, but we really think he's a good selector. So I don't know what that means.
Lawrence, now I was just thinking about Michael Vaughan was a certainly different breed of captain, very innovative, always applying his mind about the field placements, and he used to pull off things when things were really not working in his favour. What do you make of Andrew Strauss as a skipper? Because this will be an acid test for him.
Yeah, I think if he had a spectrum 0-10 of tactical ingenuity, and Vaughan was at 9 and Andrew Flintoff was at 2, you'd probably have Andrew Strauss at 5 or 6. I mean, he's got a lot to learn. He tends to be a bit negative, I'd say, a bit like Ponting. I don't think either of them are particularly great tactical captains. They both make howlers that are fairly obvious even to imbeciles like me in the press box. I think he'll get better, and I think a lot of it will depend on his handling of Swan. But then Swan is an experienced bowler and probably knows how to set his own field anyway, so it won't make a hell of a difference. I think, will it come down to Strauss v Ponting? Probably not.
I think they're about level, aren't they, really?
They are about level as tactical captains. They're also both... I mean, Ponting has a greater status as a batsman in the Australian team, but the England players follow Strauss brilliantly, and he has their respect. And I think he's almost got the Aussies' respect now. He didn't have a great series 4 years ago in Australia for a variety of reasons, but he had a very good series in 2009, and he'll be regarded, along with Kevin Peterson, I think, as the key wicket.
Now, let's come back to the other opening partner of Andrew Strauss, Alastair Cook. Now, he'll be certainly itching to go out in the middle and prove his critics wrong because he did not have a great series last time around.
Yeah, he's got to prove more than his critics wrong. I mean, he's got to prove Australia's bowlers, Australian public, media, and most of the English media wrong as well. He had a shocker in the summer. He was saved by his best innings for a long time, 110 at the Oval against Pakistan. And he actually, what he did in that innings, he kind of almost forgot his technical worries and went out there and played with a bit of freedom in conditions where no one else scored anything, really. So that was a good innings, but it hasn't convinced me or quite a few others that he's actually got over his problems. He got 100 in Perth 4 years ago, which was a good innings, kind of in vain because England were chasing about 550 in the fourth innings, but he played well. But do the Aussies fear him? No chance. I mean, they will regard him as close to a walking wicket as there is in the England team. And we can't afford to have Trott coming in against a new ball on a regular basis.
England obviously have a very settled opening pair. Mm-hmm. As against to Shane Watson, who is a makeshift opener who has succeeded in his role as an opening batsman. But what if Shane Watson fails to fire in the couple of tests? Will that call for Phil Jakes to just be in contention for the test match slot?
I don't think Phil Jakes is anywhere near it. The funny thing about Australia is during the whole 90s thing, they had a million backup middle order batsmen. You could basically go to any state and find a middle order player who could come in. Now it's all opening batsmen. So you've got Eddie Cowan, Michael Klinger, you've got Ryan Broad in Queensland, you've got Phil Jakes, and you've still got Phil Hughes. And Phil Hughes seems to be their backup batsman. His last innings against New Zealand, I think, was 80-odd not out in a test match. So I would say he would come in. I would probably go for Klinger or Cowan if it was my choice. But, yeah, I mean, if I don't think Australia can really worry about Watson failing. I mean, that's not their problem. Their problem
is one of their strengths at the moment.
Yeah,
the Watson-Katic partnership is one of their... You know, one of their few batting strengths has been working the last year.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think that Watson's going to have that much of trouble. In England, I think he might eventually get worked out with the swinging ball. But I think in Australia, he should be okay against England. But I think the problem will be whether they need to move him down to shore up the middle order, which is what Ponting wants to do with him, but not what the selectors or what Watson wants to do.
Now, when Glenn McGrath used to play test matches, he used to single out one batsman from the opposition. No such thing happening in these kind of days now. What do you make out of it? Because that really kills the enthusiasm and the eagerness to go to a series.
Well, I'd put it this way. If Mitchell Johnson started shouting the odds after the way he bowled in 2009, I think England could rightly laugh in his face.
Though, I think he did single out Strauss, though, didn't he?
He may have done.
It's
yeah,
just
probably.
No one cared.
Well, no one takes... I mean, if you've taken 563 wickets at 24, like whatever Glenn McGrath's average was, you can start to say these things and people will... sit up and take notice. I mean, if you ever spoke to Shane Warne today, I mean, he can come out with some outrageous stuff, but because Warne says it, it actually counts for something. There is no one on either side who's got the nous or the gravitas to make these predictions and be treated with anything other than disdain by the opposition. And that is the reality of this series. It's mid-table teams not quite going hammer and tongs because they're not quite good enough to go hammer and tongs, but waiting to see who blinks first, who's going to slip up first. In that sense, it'll be a gripping series, a bit like 2009, two sort of mid-table sides, fearful of defeat and hoping to grab those moments like England did, the crucial moments. You know, Aussies dominated England statistically, but England seemed to win the moments that counted.
Now, Jared, just coming back to now the Australian middle order, sounded very brittle indeed, because I still believe that they have the firepower, but in terms of a batting unit which can pose totals and cushion the bowlers, do you think Michael Clarke, Ricky Ponting... and Michael Hussey, who has come under serious scrutiny, have the guts to actually produce 500 runs on a continuous basis and put the English bowlers in any sort of pressure?
It's not the 500 run totals I worry about, because when Australians get on top on a good pitch, they'll make 500. My problem is when they get on a bad pitch, will they make 200? And that's been their problem, is just collapsing for under 200. And the problem is that you've got Marcus North, who's one of the worst starters in Test cricket history. He's got an average of 35 and his conversion rate of hundreds is really good. So the reason he averages 35 is because the other three times he's basically making under 10. And he does it over and over again. Then you've got Mike Hussey, who's made 300s in 35 tests, who's averaged about 35 in that time. So you've got two guys really averaging 35 in the middle. Brad Haddin, who averages 40 but can be up and down. Now, Clark and Ponting, I don't have too many worries about. Clark had a bad series and is going through an emotional crisis, but he looks to me pretty level-headed when he bats, so I don't have a problem. But if these other two keep going out one after the other, which is what happens, they both seem to fail at the one time, suddenly Haddin has to come in and he can't play his natural game. That's a big problem. I would get rid of both of them. I have no idea why they're still on the side. I would have got rid of North about a year ago.
Having said that, now, batsmen usually in their early 30s tend to mature as the wine matures with age. Now, with Michael Clarke, that has not happened. He has tapered off suddenly. Started 6-7 seasons back, looked a very confident cricketer, and suddenly the runs are eluding to him. What do you see as the main reason why there is a shift of focus or too much of things getting hussed up in the mind?
No, I disagree. I think Michael Clarke's made a lot of runs over the last couple of years. He's been probably Australia's most consistent batsman over the last 2 years. He's averaging 49 in Test cricket. When he was in that early period, he averaged in his early 40s. So, I mean, he's really shored his spot. His problem is that he always seems to do something stupid off the field. He has such a lack of personality that he seems to find himself in stupid positions, whether it's going out with a model who's, you know, sleeps around with footballers, or whether it's this time where he seems to have alienated everyone in the Australian team. Like, this isn't the first time he's alienated all his teammates. Like, him and Andrew Symonds and him went from best friends to not talking anymore. Now it looks like the Australian team are ready to lynch him. runs wise, up until he made his top scorer was against New Zealand. That's his top scorer in Test cricket. It was only recent times. He made a lot of runs in the Ashes. I thought he was probably Australia's most consistent batsman in the Ashes. But yeah, mentally, you know, put a cork in him, he's done.
I think this Ashes series will be an even contest between a bat and a ball, because traditionally, now that we see the test cricket is being followed quite enthusiastically amongst a lot of nations, and with matches close and with a tendency to score more than 4.5 runs, 4 runs and over, will it produce that kind of a cricket that the fans are really hoping for?
I think there'll be periods of, I think there'll be dull periods, and I think because both sides are prone to collapse. Look at Adelaide 4 years ago, okay, 550 plays 520, and then England have a brainstorm and lose it on the last day. I wouldn't put
that. Is that
what
happened?
Yeah. We won't get into other matches, that close matches that Australia have lost. But both teams have got the capacity to self-destruct, and I think that's what will make the series interesting. I keep saying 2-2 because I don't think there'll be many draws. Rain might come into one of them. But I just think they're so even in their sort of mediocrity that they could cancel each other out. And it may come down to luck. Who has fewer off days than the other? And for whatever reason, it's too close to call, and that's one of the beauties of it.
Now, coming back to the point of the middle order batting, do you think Owen Morgan has clearly the most important role to play? His ascent as a test batsman has been pretty interestingly poised, and his rise to the top, and he's now maturing as a batsman. Do you think this tour can make or break him as a test batsman?
No, I suspect it'll do neither. I mean, he won't start at Brisbane. I mean, Ian Bell will start at 6. Morgan scored a very good 130 against Pakistan at Trent Bridge first test in a match-winning partnership of 200 with Collingwood. No one else in the match on either side scored any runs. That was a class innings. And then he scored 45 runs in his next 5 test innings. So Morgan, there are issues outside off stump in test cricket, without a doubt. He's a brilliantly inventive one-day player, and he'd probably be in a World 11 in 50-over cricket. But I don't think he'll start in the test team, and it will require someone like Bell or Peterson even, dare I suggest, or Trott to have a shocker in the first 2 tests. Now, maybe England will get to Sydney 1 test down, and because Morgan's such a good player of spin, and Sydney's a traditional turner of all the Australian venues, they'll give him a game and say, well, we've got to lose, we need to win this game. But I just think that Bell is a changed player now, and I think a class operator at number 6. Other positions, it's up for grabs. But Morgan won't start the series.
But having said that, Ian Bell and then Jonathan Trott and Owen Morgan, which is the weakest link at the moment in terms of getting opportunities to play and also score runs in Australia?
Morgan. Because he's a few tests into his test career. He's a slip catch waiting to happen in test cricket. He's unproven, unlike the other two. I know Aussies laugh at Ian Bell, but he is a different player now from the guy who... Okay, last time he came in at number 3 at the Oval and scored a very crucial 72 that gets forgotten about. So it was a 72.
But having said that, I think the role of Stuart Broad will also be crucial, because remember, he's coming from a test match 100, and in fact that was a career best contribution. What do you think the all-rounder slot will be in for a debate, and Stuart Broad has a lot to offer for the England camp?
Well, he'll certainly start at number 8 after that 169. He was batting at 9 for a while. Swan went above him, and Swan, who'd been averaging 35 at 9, was suddenly averaging 11 at 8. So those two will swap round again. Broad is essentially a fast bowler who, if you get one very good innings out of him a series, you're happy. He's not an all-rounder at the moment. He tried batting at number 7 at Headingley in 2009 against Australia and looked at least 2 places out of his depth. And I think in maybe 3 or 4 years' time, he may, if his batting keeps improving, you may think of him as a number 7 who could actually balance the team in the way that Flintoff used to, but we're way off that territory at the moment. I see him as a guy who could win a test match in the right conditions. Don't forget the Oval, his spell, it rained before he came on. And well, though, he bowled, and miserably, though, Australia batted. The conditions helped him. So if it rains a bit at Brisbane, and he gets to bowl just after, or Melbourne even, you know, Broad could win England the series. That's the optimistic view.
But Mitchell Johnson now certainly did not enjoy bowling in English conditions last time around. Struggled and sprayed the ball to all parts of the pitch. He'll be leading the attack now this time around. Do you see a change Mitchell Johnson coming into the Ashes series now that he's spearheading the attack?
I don't think he's going to lead the attack anymore. I think they'll use him as the main wicket taker, but I think Hilfenhaus or Siddle will probably lead the attack just because they're more solid individuals and they're less likely to lose the plot. But having said that, Johnson is at his best in Australia. He likes the pitches a lot harder. He's never really bowled anywhere well when the pitches haven't, you know, been hard. So I think he likes to hit the pitch. So I'm not 100% sure where he's going to go, but he's important to Australia because he can bat at eight. He's not a better batsman than Broad, but like Broad, he's probably good for one, maybe one and a half good innings. So he gives them that buffer before you get to the tail. But he's not. I don't think they'll let him lead the attack anymore, just because, a bit like Harmison, he can lead your attack into the promised land or he can lead you into a brick wall.
But having said that, Peter Siddle is just deemed fit and just has a couple of matches under his belt. Do you think Ricky Ponting will actually experiment with Peter Siddle as the lead bowler and keep Mitchell Johnson as a backup?
Well, he doesn't have to because he's got Hilfenhaus. Hilfenhaus has been taking the first over for Australia. And generally the way Australians do it is whoever's taking the first over is leading the attack. So Hilfenhaus has had that job for a while now. They usually give it to Siddle when Siddle's there because he's the most aggressive. I don't think they're going to worry too much. I think Victoria have two more Shield games, so he would have played four Shield games by then. Four first-class games coming into a Test match is pretty good, really. A couple of one days against Sri Lanka. According to the Tasmanian boys, he was bowling as quick as anyone when they faced him in the Shield game. So he seems fit. They held him back from India to keep him in peak condition, so that seems to have helped him. That doesn't mean he's necessarily going to get in the side, but I think Hilfenhaus and Siddle are more natural leaders of a bowling attack than Johnson, who's clearly mental.
Your thoughts, gentlemen, in terms of drop catches, so the role of wicketkeeper comes and becomes more crucial. How do you see Tim Payne shaping up, or Brad Haddin will feature for the wicketkeeper slot?
Well, unfortunately, Brad Haddin will keep. The actual level of keeping between the two of them is about the same. Neither of them can really keep. But Payne is by far the better batsman and by far the better prospect. I thought when Gilchrist retired, Payne would have been the better one to come in. They didn't take that role, so now they've given three years to a guy who's 34. I don't see the point in having someone like Haddin, who's just a middling cricketer, really, not that special. I think in Australia, Australian keepers generally keep better because they like the ball carrying through. But I think Pryor is probably the best keeper in the series at the moment. And, you know, a year ago, I probably would have laughed when I said that.
Matt Pryor's good year. He collected catches cleanly. He kept well to Graham Swan and scored runs with the bat. Do you see his role as a crucial thing when England are in a spot of bother because he has the ability to take England camp towards safety?
Yeah, as number sevens go, he's a top class number seven. He averages 42, I think, which no England keeper has ever really done that as a keeper. I mean, you go back to Alex Stewart averaged 47 as an opener. As a keeper, it dropped below 40. I think you have to go back to Les Ames way back in the 20th century, averaged about 40 as a keeper. But so we're in a kind of uncharted waters here. Pryor's keeping has improved massively. I mean, when he started in 2007, he was mocked. He was regarded as a loudmouth. He was a sledge to Sachin Tendulkar, was misinterpreted and used against him. And people thought, oh, typical England, they're sacrificing wicket-keeping skills for they're sticking gloves on a batsman, essentially. Now I think he's an excellent counter-attacker. He can also rescue the team from bad situations. Second innings at Trent Bridge against Pakistan, very good 100. And his keeping is now, it's like football referees, isn't it? You don't notice them if they're doing a good job. And Pryor, no one has commented on Pryor's keeping for quite a long time.
I have.
Jared has, but Jared comments on most things. Doesn't need a second invitation.
No, I have, because his keeping has improved. And I used to take the piss because he was terrible. He did look like a shaved monkey that they'd put gloves on. And now he can wicketkeep like a human. My problem is that since he's become a good wicketkeeper, his batting has dropped about 8. Overall, he's gone from averaging about 50 to averaging about 42.
The balance is hard to strike.
And I think that's a really tough thing. And it's going to be the same with Payne. Payne could bat at 6 for Australia without a problem. But whether his keeping's ever going to be good enough to keep that balance is...
Gentlemen, coming back to the point of venues now, do you think both sides should have a strategy of horses for courses, or probably if they're winning, then not to disturb a winning combination and go with the same side? What are your thoughts, Lawrence?
Well, I think there has to be some flexibility. I think the days of each Australian venue having a very specific character are not quite gone, but they're vanishing. There's a sort of homogeneity about the pitches now. I mean, Sydney, sure, it'll turn. Adelaide will be the flattest. Brisbane will offer a bit of seam and swing if you're lucky as a bowler. Melbourne kind of depends on the weather. And Perth, from what I saw the other day in a one day, there's still a bit of bounce there, though it's not quite the trampoline of old. So they have to be flexible. They've got the Lions squad out there, don't forget. So England, in a sense, are picking from a team of 30. They've planned this tour better than any other. There'll be no excuses this time. I mean, they can pick from guys in the second tier, could leapfrog guys in the first squad of 17, if needs be. They've got a second spinner in Panesar, who may be chosen for Sydney, depending on the circumstances. Don't rule him out for Adelaide, but doesn't turn as much as most people sort of seem to think at Adelaide.
How do you fit Chris Tremlett? He has been inducted into the side because of his height and probably extract extra amount of bounce in Brisbane.
Well, Perth would be the obvious pitch for Tremlett, but it's a curious one, Tremlett. I mean, he was kind of disregarded under the Duncan Fletcher reign because they thought he lacked ticker, and though he's got all the attributes for a fast bowler, he's tall, he does get bounce, and he does bowl some cracking spells, but he somehow lacks the kind of the fight and the snarl that fast bowlers are supposed to have. They're saying since he went from Hampshire to Surrey that that's changed. Well, great if it has. I mean, I'd still place the other guys ahead of him. I think it would need an injury for him to get a test match.
He looked a little bit snarly. Although, I mean, obviously saw Surrey play a little bit this year. He looked a little bit more aggressive than I've seen him in the past. But I think the big problem is, it's a bit like when you go to India and you say, oh, we've got to take a bunch of spinners. You go to Australia and you go, we've got to take a bunch of tall bowlers. Really, your bowler's good. He's going to take wickets in Australia.
So he just might warm up the benches, all you know?
There's a big chance there. I think there's a very big chance he won't play at all.
Australia's bowling tactics as well. Mitchell Johnson, genuine strike bowler. And the spinner has been a long debated thing in Australian history, and after the departure of Shane Warne, nobody has got the guts or the skill to those large amount of boots now. How do you reckon the role of the spinner?
Well, like I said before, I just wouldn't play one. I don't think there's any point in playing a bowler if he's not up to test class just because he's a spinner. Probably the best spinner in Australian domestic cricket is still Bryce McGain, who's 38 now and has played one test and been smashed. The second best spinner in Australian domestic cricketer is Xavier Doherty with an average of 48. What's the point of playing someone with
that? You won't even play him at SCG or probably Adelaide Oval?
Well, the thing about these pitches is that in Shield cricket, you have a lot of spinners play at the SCG and Adelaide Oval, yet they're not taking any wickets in Shield cricket. So why at the step up would they suddenly start taking wickets? I've never understood this theory that they're going to get play for Test cricket and suddenly work. Xavier Doherty took a 5 or a 6 wicket haul against Victoria this year. If he takes a couple more 6 wicket hauls, I'd probably pick him above Horrocks. They're not going to do that. They're going to keep Horrocks anyway. So if that's the case, why not pick your best 4 seamers and then use North or Clark as your backup?
But there is a theory that goes into play that English players are typically susceptible against spin bowling. So why not introduce spin bowling options to English players?
I think there are certain English players that have suffered in the past. But if you've got a team with Cook, perhaps Morgan and Trott, I mean, they're going to struggle outside off stump more than they're going to struggle with spin bowlers. So why would you put in a rubbish off spinner like Horrocks just because he's a spin bowler? If Bryce McGain, if they picked him, he might trouble them. He played one game for Essex and I think took eight wickets. And I think, you know, he took enough wickets in county cricket to show that English players still have trouble with wrist spin. Whether they still have trouble with finger spin, I can't see it. There seems to be a lot of quality finger spinners in England. Even backup guys like, you know, Patel and Diesel and Panesar and...
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a myth. I mean,
wrist spin, I think, is a big problem for English.
Well, the England guys sweep much better. Bell, actually, you'll note, if Bell's facing a spinner, he hasn't first up, he'll sweep. First ball, always. There's a little paddle sweep for a single. They all sweep much more comfortably. The only reason to have Horrocks in the team, as well as I can tell, is to get Andrew Strauss out, because he got him a few times in 2009, and there may be a bit of a weird kind of mental thing going on there. But other than that, I agree with Jared. Pick your 4 best bowlers. If you've got North to bowl perfectly serviceable off-spin, and Clark, get the left arm on against Peterson.
Yeah, well, I think North, I've always thought that North was as talented as Horrocks. He just doesn't bowl as much. And the reason he doesn't bowl is because he can bat. And I think Imran Tahir, Danish Kaneria, Bryce McGain, Piyush Chawla, all taking bunches of wickets in county cricket. Very few finger spinners have taken anywhere near that amount. So I don't see just putting someone in because they bowl finger spin.
Now let's come to an interesting point of Kevin Peterson, because a lot has been said about Kevin Peterson's form going into the Ashes series, as the records book suggests, that averaging 49 now. He had a torrid time. He has a tendency to get out at the wrong times after being get set for a big score. So how do you see his preparation shaping up for the Ashes series? 3 crucial games, practice games. If he doesn't score runs, Will he be in the right frame of mind to fire him at Brisbane?
Yeah, fun. I never thought I'd say this, but Kevin Peterson v West Australia, South Australia and Australia A is suddenly shaping up as possibly the most crucial factor of this Ashes series. He's got to get in the right frame of mind. He went to South Africa to play a couple of games for Natal to work with his old mentor and coach Graham Ford. Now he got 36 and a second ball duck and then didn't get another knock. So in that sense, it wasn't a great success. But I think that the work he did off the field seems to have instilled him with a bit more confidence. I think more crucially with Peterson is the fact that it's an Ashes series and he just likes people looking at him. And he knows this is a crucial winter for him. His legacy could be determined by what happens this winter, not just the Ashes, but the World Cup. And Nasser Hussain keeps saying that he took his eye off the ball in the summer. Had a great, he was player of the tournament at the World 2020, didn't prepare properly for Bangladesh, is what Nasser says. And then when Pakistan started swinging it everywhere, he was in no sort of nick, had no county to play for either.
But don't you think, Lawrence, that it would not have been a bad ploy to just take some time off, recharge your batteries, rather than try and get into a patchy kind of a form and negative mindset of not scoring runs and come to Ashes under immense amount of pressure?
Well, that wasn't the plan. I mean, he planned to score runs when he went to South Africa. And actually, England dropped him before that. They dropped him from the one-day series against Pakistan.
Rested,
yeah, exactly. Whatever you want to call it, he did not play against Pakistan. And because England wanted to do precisely what you're suggesting, though, they wanted to give him a kick up the backside and say, hey, no man is bigger than this team, and certainly not you, KP. You haven't scored any runs for us recently. You're not playing. I personally think he'll be fine. I just think he likes these big scenarios. He's got a great Ashes record. He averages 47 in Test cricket and 50 against Australia, and very few England players have done that in the last 40, 50 years.
I think he's, well, for England in general, but definitely for him, he's playing against maybe the weakest Shield team I've seen in 20 years of following Shield cricket. So if he doesn't make runs against Western Australia, he should probably kill himself.
All right, so the verdict is fairly loud and clear that Kevin Peterson should score runs and score them heavily in the lead up to the Ashes series. Now, gentlemen, in terms of who do you pick, Jared, the player to watch out for?
I suppose the most important player is going to be someone innocuous like Marcus North. If he plays and his first three tests he scores five ducks, then it's very hard for Australia to come back from that. They need someone in the middle order to make runs. I've given up on Mike Hussey. So if they don't have someone out of probably Brad Hatton or Marcus North to have a good series, then I can't see them making enough runs because I think they're going to collapse a lot. So, I mean, I'm picking maybe the most boring cricketer in the world, but Marcus North is very important to Australia's chances.
You don't think Ricky Ponting still has in it him in order to assert himself in the series?
He can assert himself, but if, like I said before, if the top three batsmen all get 70 odds and Australia are 3 for 210, they can still be all out for 260. The problem is that Ponting doesn't make big hundreds anymore. Katic doesn't make hundreds at all, and Watson makes just 100. So if you add those up, the chances are that they're not going to all make 70 or 90 or 100 every time. It has to be the middle order that backs them up, otherwise it's useless. I mean, I like the top three, I just don't see that being the main part of the series. And for England, I don't, unless Swan has an amazing series, and I don't see it happening, I don't think they have anyone who can change the series. I just think they're better overall.
All right, Lawrence, your pick.
Well, Jared said that North was possibly the most boring, or whatever the word he used, cricketer in the world, but I'm going to trump him with my potential pick of the series, which is Jonathan Trott. I think that England will need someone to bat long and bat boring and bat old-fashioned because they're going to be panicking a lot, and a lot's been made of Trott's so-called mental frailties, but I think that's been overblown. I mean, look, a guy comes in, Test debut, and an Ashes decider scores 100. That's good enough for me. Under pressure, okay, admittedly against Bangladesh, but gets a double 100, and then a fantastic innings, whatever you say about that Lord's, the validity of that Lord's Test match against Pakistan, a world-class innings from number three in seeming conditions. So I just think if Trott can bat for hour upon hour, he'll get under the Aussies' nose, he'll make them sweat in the field, he will irritate them, and he'll allow others to bat round him. I mean, Peterson could go berserk at the other end while Trott's just blocking it, and you could suddenly have a really sort of weird little and large kind of combination that drives Australia to distraction. So go Trotty.
That's an interesting choice. I was not expecting
the two most boring batsmen.
Yeah, that's right. But then How about Andrew Strauss? Because he's such a key player at the top of the order and can guide the number two and number three batsmen by building and stitching important partnerships in the middle.
Yeah, well, I think it was Vaughan who said recently, if Strauss averages 50, England will win. If he averages 25, they'll lose. And Australia will target him. He is, along with Peterson, I think Trott's going under the radar here, incidentally, which will suit him just fine. But I think Australia will think that Peterson and Strauss are the two key wickets. And
I don't think Australia are that worried about Trott, only because it's a bit like Bell and Cook, in that they think that while those guys are there, they don't score at a rate that's going to hurt them. And Australians generally worry about the batsmen who are going to score at a decent rate. And it's a bit like Cook. Cook can make a lot of runs, but Australia basically always think they're going to get him out and he's never going to have that big of a score. And I think that might be Trott's problem. He has to find a way, maybe an extra scoring shot, because he basically flicks off his hip like David Boone did all day. And in the old days, you could do that. Now with the computers, they're just going to work out and bowl a foot outside off stump to him. And I don't know if he has the patience outside off stump in Australia. I'm not 100% sure I trust him.
What is the scoreline? What do you predict as the scoreline that is going to happen after the Ashes series? Very bold question, but I can't resist myself from asking that question.
Well, it's clearly going to be 2-2.
Clearly.
There is no doubt about it. And with England winning at Sydney, which has happened in the past, mainly when England have been 3 or 4 nil down.
Yeah.
But I don't know, there's something about this England team. There's also something about this Australia team which makes you think they could stuff it up in ways that you're not used to. So I think it'll ebb and flow. I think momentum is an overrated concept in modern sport, especially in a 5-test series. Momentum basically doesn't exist. In fact, you don't want momentum too early. You want to hit momentum around the 4th test.
That's why people like Lawrence Booth, because he says things like that. I agree with him 100%. I hate momentum. Sorry.
2-2.
You had the momentum then and I paused you.
Well, you've just ruined your own argument. You've destroyed my momentum. But 2-2 because I think there'll be ebb and flow. There are two evenly matched sides. I think Australia's home advantage will count for something, but Swan will count for something as well.
Jared, your pick?
I think 2-1, and I'm going to go with Australia. I'm not that confident that Australia are a winning team, but I think that there will be 2 draws. I think there's going to be a bit of rain because the drought's broken in Australia. So it's been very hot, like in Melbourne last year. Obviously, they had over the last couple of years, had the bushfires and things like that. I don't think it'll be as hot. I think it'll be a bit more wet, and I think probably Sydney or Adelaide could be drawn, and they're probably England's best chances of winning. So I think they might eke out a win in somewhere like Melbourne, but I think at the Gabba and at the Wacker, Australia should win those tests.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for hearing your thoughts about the Ashes series. Only time will tell who gets the hand on that coveted Ashes trophy. Until the next episode of Cricket Central, it is goodbye from Amit Masram.